Hello, my name is Dr. Thomas Round, and I'm one of the RCGP e-learning fellows. And today it's a real privilege to have Professor Carolyn Chew-Graham and Dr. David Shears, and we're talking about serious mental health issues and physical health. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
Good morning, Thomas.
Carolyn, can you just give me a little overview about yourself?
So I'm a general practitioner in Manchester, and I'm Professor of General Practice Research at Keele University, and do quite a bit of research around common mental health problems, but also importantly about physical health in people with severe mental illness.
And David?
I come from Leek in North Staffordshire, a little market town. I was a former GP. The main reason I'm on the podcast today is to talk about some of my experiences as a carer of a daughter who developed schizophrenia when she was 16, which is over 30 years ago now. Mary currently lives in a little local residential care home where she needs support for virtually every aspect of her life, but she's got great quality of life.
It's really great to get dual aspect, a little bit of general practice, but also seeing it from the other side as a carer and supporting someone with SMI. What conditions do we mean when we're talking about serious mental health problems?
So severe mental illness, or SMI, there are behavioural, mental and emotional disorders, which importantly cause functional impairment. So it interferes with people's quality of life. So severe mental illness includes bipolar disorder, major depressive disorder with psychosis, schizophrenia and schizoaffective disorder.
David, could you describe a little bit about Mary's narrative and why SMI is so important to you?
So Mary, happy at school, very active, very fit, loved animals, started to get into difficulties in her sort of early teens, sort of intellectually falling off from others at school, and then rapid escalation, moody, paranoid, unhappy. And after about 6 weeks, clumsy suicide attempt, but the alarm bells were all absolutely ringing. Psychiatrists visited Mary at home and quite confidently diagnosed that she had this condition called schizophrenia. So I'm an experienced GP, my wife's a nurse, and yet neither of us had really anticipated that diagnosis. Pretty much life shut down. Mary was seen every couple of weeks in a CAMHS clinic where the medicines were adjusted. It was essentially just a medicines clinic. My wife stopped work as a nurse to give Mary one-to-one. General practice was sort of recluse for me in a sense. You know, I'd come back at home not sure when what would be going on. So that was a pretty chaotic 12 months. But actually, Anne and I had no inkling about what was ahead of us. So at the end of about 12 months, then again, rapid escalation, paranoia to the whole family, and Mary went into an acute adult ward. In fact, the psychiatrist at the time advised us that if we could just hang on till the adult service, they were more into psychosis. So Mary went from a CAM service that didn't do psychosis to what very quickly became clear that it was an adult service that didn't deal with young people. So there's a huge sort of gap. And her mental health just got worse. Everyone kept saying, oh, she'll get better. We've just got to find the right medicine. But certainly she didn't. And then after 6 months of that, she ended up in a rehabilitation unit, so-called, in our local asylum, which was actually in my practice area. So Mary, in the space of about 2.5 years, had gone from fit, active, 9 stone in weight, to sedated, hardly able to stand, nothing to do, forgotten by her friends, and 13.5 stone. So she'd put on 4.5 stone. Although she was taking these drugs that made her eat, you know, huge appetite stimulant, they were giving extra helpings of puddings because they felt sorry for her. It was a stark, impoverished environment. And there was me as a GP giving advice to people that were, you know, 20, 30, 40 years older on how they should avoid heart disease and diabetes. Mary, at the age of 18, 19, apart from dealing with this severe mental illness, was exposed to all the risks that I was busy pontificating about in the surgery. And there she was in this environment. Actually, the other thing I remember was there's the smoking. Smoking was the culture of this service. You know, Mary would wander around the corridors and there'd be old men smoking. The one good thing from Mary's point of view is she never took up smoking. You know, you could see that this was an environment where if you didn't smoke before you came into hospital, you were highly likely to smoke by the time you left it. On top of all these other things that I could see was going to give Mary big trouble in later times. The problem at that time was just trying to control this awful illness, this psychotic illness. So that was the setting, that, you know, very impoverished environment. This wasn't a lifestyle choice. This was stoking the fires for future ill health.
And David, then that led on to you being interested in physical health as well as mental health conditions.
Well, it was a tough time. The little sunshine was that this amazing psychiatrist started in this so-called rehabilitation service. Two things. She said, well, look, Mary shouldn't really be here. And I think you ought to complain about my service, which is really quite a brave thing to say as a clinician. Mm. And then the other thing she said was, look, there's this drug called clozapine. She described this drug being taken off the market because of the issues of blood dyscrasias. And that was the main reason, but had been brought back because of demand from people who've been on it. And so it's a drug that's reserved for people who've not responded to the sort of conventional antipsychotics. And it worked for Mary. In a sense, it worked because the psychosis diminished immediately. But, you know, right drug, wrong place. She was still in this environment. The complaint, I ended up with a sort of put up or shut up. And the opportunity to work with people like Fiona and a few others who were really interested in this idea of early intervention. And in mental health at that time, those words were just not used. So, as you know, as a GP, you know, we'd be sued if we didn't take signs of a heart problem or, you know what I mean? But for mental health, it didn't seem to matter. So this idea of early intervention, I just found it irresistible. And so I then eventually stopped my work as a GP, a big career change, to become a joint lead on a national program for developing early intervention when it didn't exist. So it was a crazy idea, really. But so I sort of became completely obsessed and worked with a great clinical psychologist called Joe Smith. And we co-led this program through the era of the National Service Framework. Yeah, I mean, that was an interesting experience. Interesting because, you know, from my GP perspective, this was about the opportunity to actually proactively work with people, to actually give them support into mental health services, not like Mary had experienced, you know, a CAM service that didn't do psychosis or an adult service that didn't do young people. We actually wanted to craft a service that did respond to the needs, because this is the typical age, you know, when young people develop their severe mental illness. The thing that never left me was this idea that this isn't just about people's mental health, serious as it was for Mary at the beginning, but actually, they're on a trajectory. You know, Mary's physical health was clearly going to be a problem as she got older. And so, you know, the combination of poor physical health, poor mental health, I think you can trace it back really to the early phase of the illness. And there's your opportunity. That really transformed me inside me to want to do something about that.
Yeah. That's amazing. Thank you, David, for sharing that. I know that could be quite difficult for you to share, so thank you very much. And we'll touch a little bit of maybe about Mary's health going forward and where we are now. I guess if it's okay to pose a question to you, Carolyn, about the mortality gap. So in general practice, we're quite aware of this, I think, but why does this happen? So when we think people with SMI, they do die younger than the general population.
Yeah, and that is about 15 to 20 years earlier than the general population. And I think what is also astounding is that it hasn't changed, and it may even be getting wider, that gap. And as David's alluded to, it's the physical health problems that contribute to the mortality gap. So people with SMI may not be able to take up activity, or they may smoke, as David's pointed out. They are given drugs that cause cardiometabolic side effects, so hyperlipidemia and high blood sugar, so contributing then to the development of diabetes, heart disease and stroke. So these physical health problems are what contribute to the mortality gap. And some of it is iatrogenic, some of it we cause by giving drugs that have these side effects. But there are other physical health problems. So David's alluded to smoking. So people with SMI are more likely to smoke than the general population. And so COPD is common in people with SMI. But then there are also initiatives that we have in the health service. So offering breast screening, cervical screening, aortic aneurysm screening, and people with SMI are less likely to take up those screening opportunities. And the way they may present or may not present, may not understand the significance of symptoms. So a diagnosis of cancer will be made later in somebody with SMI. So there's a whole load of factors that really contribute to this mortality gap.
David, I don't know if you wanted to comment a bit on that, about sort of your own experience.
I mean, the thing that matters for someone like Mary is access to someone that she knows and trusts. That's an aspect I'd be really keen to talk about, is the importance of having continuity of relationship. And the other thing, of course, is having a life worth living. So, you know, if you don't really feel your life's got purpose, and what's the point? Mary wasn't scared about getting diabetes or heart disease. That was not on her radar. What she hated was not being like her peers. I mean, she loves dressing up. She still does. And dancing and all those sorts of things. It was really important to her. Her life was defined by what she couldn't do, and particularly about the relationship. So I think there's that sort of social side of it going on. But from a primary care perspective, these are people who actually do require, I think, relationship. It takes time, and it takes a lot more time than you would do for someone who's not got a severe mental illness. But they'll trust you generally, and they'll listen, and they will take things in slowly. They need a lot of repeating. I mean, Mary's effectively got learning disability now. It's very similar. I mean, I think that's the sort of way I'd approach it.
Yeah, I think you're right there, isn't it? Thinking about how we might approach someone with a learning disability. And also you mentioned the continuity in that. I think we touched on that, Carolyn, and myself in previous podcasts, how important that is. It is a challenge within general practice, but we know from work in the BJGP and other publications that actually you get better patient outcomes and also better health system outcomes as well if you have improved continuity of care.
And we know that for people with SMI, good continuity of care means less hospital admissions. So there's an economic argument as well as the sort of health argument and the argument for the individual. I think for people with SMI, having the constant of a GP is important, but also often healthcare assistants or social prescribers or nurse practitioners who will do the health check-in practices, and it will vary across practices. But I think if that can be a constant, that is really helpful because people may not come into an invitation that's sent by text, but if somebody that they saw last year who did their health check and established a relationship with them rings them and says, oh, why don't you pop in? What day is good for you? So it's personalised and there is somebody there that this person knows and trusts, they're much more likely to come in for the annual health check. But they may also respond to, you know, well, okay, so they didn't do the bowel screening, but that healthcare assistant rings them up and goes, oh, you didn't do that. Do you want me to organise for you to get it again? Can I help you? Can you come in and we'll talk about it? Again, it's about us in primary care reaching out to people who've got individual needs.
Yeah, and a bit of that proactivity you said as well. Thinking then about identifying and doing that sort of physical health check, what do we mean by that? What is a good quality physical health check within general practice for someone with SMI?
I mean, looking back from Mary's perspective, cardiovascular disease and diabetes and obesity. So in the late 90s, when this was sort of really fresh in my face, these were the big things that we were dealing with as primary care, you know, setting up systems for proactive prevention advice, not, you know, run by the practice nurses. So those were the big things. There obviously, there's a whole range of health issues for this population. Touched on cancer screening, you know, they have higher rates. The problem is late diagnosis, I think, with cancer and poor access to some of the treatments. But there's a whole host of other things, sexual health, oral health. But the big hitters, I think, are heart disease and diabetes. So those were the things that I would go for at core. But to be aware, there's a whole range of health issues. I mean, that's just sort of my general approach to this.
I absolutely agree that it should be broader than it is, but it's dictated by the quality and outcomes framework. And we know, David, don't we, that when the quality and outcomes framework for mental health, particularly around severe mental illness, was introduced, there were about 20 indicators. And these have been whittled away. And I think we wrote to the BMJ and said, if you take away the indicators, the work won't be done. And that's exactly what happened. Yep. So the work is done where the box needs to be ticked. As a GP, I understand this. This is our income. But it means that there are some things that are evidence-based in NICE guidelines, but aren't actually done. So I think the health check is fairly narrow, but it's better than nothing. You know, as I've said, I think it's a way into establishing a relationship with people with SMI, getting them developing trust in the practice. And I think the key thing is that people with SMI, 50% of them are managed totally in primary care. We tend to think, oh, you know, these people are managed in secondary care. It's secondary care responsibility. Even if somebody is in secondary care, either in an early intervention service or in a community mental health team, the physical health check may not be done. So it's down to primary care. And if a person is solely managed in primary care, then it is down to us. Whilst I think there are limitations of the current health check, it is better than nothing. It does focus on cardiovascular disease and diabetes, which, as David says, are the big hitters.
I think it's making sure within your practice, understanding your systems, as we said, for recall, making sure there's flexibility with the recall system, making sure the staff are trained, isn't it, about approaching maybe longer appointments.
I mean, here's my challenge to you two. This starts early. You know, so Mary's trajectory towards obesity, that was pretty quick. That was 2 years, 50% weight gain. And then a trajectory towards diabetes, probably another 5-10 years, if, you know, hopefully, and heart disease eventually. The point really is it's very early. Now, that's a challenge, isn't it? I mean, in some ways, as a carer, I don't care who sorts this out, but it's really important that you talk, that you connect with your specialist services. So early intervention services now is like standard. There's a real challenge. You know, I'd want to have very proactive physical health support through that service for my daughter. I would like to know my GP as well. I'd like to think that primary care was engaged because that trajectory, it's no use waiting 10 years 15 years. The horse has bolted. I think it's a really critical time in that first 2-3 years on how you produce a very integrated model of care so that the initial responsibilities for making sure people's physical health is taken seriously clearly lie with the prescriber. You know, there's no question of that. But at some point, you've then got to think, how do you integrate this system so that I, as a family member, can be comfortable knowing whether I'm talking to the psychiatrist and that my GP is aware of what's going on and that I can go to my GP if I'm concerned. I'm not saying it's easy, but if we miss those first few years, I think we've missed the boat, really, for this population. Yeah.
I mean, I think you've brought out a really important point, David, that people who start on an antipsychotic can put on at least 12 kilograms in the first 2 years, sometimes more. And it's usually then when they're in the early intervention service, and often they don't have any contact with primary care because early intervention services are fantastic. They have a case manager, they have family therapy. And we know from our work in the Extend study, don't we, David, that people really value early intervention services. And as you say, it is down to the prescriber to look at physical health. And so I suppose from my perspective, as a GP, we expect that the physical health will be monitored in the early intervention service. But we do, I think, have a responsibility to make sure that is done and, you know, maybe invite people in, even if it means duplication, but it's establishing the relationship. Because what we also know from our work in the Extend study, which was published in BJGP, is that people lose contact with primary care in their early intervention in psychosis service. And then if they're discharged back to primary care, which the majority will be, some will go to CMA, HT obviously with primary care, but many will come back to primary care without any specialist input. We need to have established a relationship with them. And otherwise, people have described it as falling off a cliff, that, you know, they've had this fantastic intervention in the early intervention psychosis service, and then they feel they're bereft, they've got nothing. So if we as GPs could establish the relationship at the start of an illness, get involved in management of physical health and support, then going forwards, hopefully the person with severe mental illness and their families, their carers, will think of primary care as somewhere to go to get help.
One thought about that. So look, I've gone through the service, we're coming out, we're doing okay, and 2 or 3 years into this service, we're not talking about large numbers of people here. Typical GP, I guess you're going to see 1 or 2 people per year with a new onset psychosis. You're not going to flood the surges with this. I put forward a single intervention could be as simple as a care coordinator arranging for a patient and their family member to visit the GP and go with them and actually have a sit down, have a consultation. This is the intervention, a chat, a consultation together. And at that point, GPs will say, well, look, you know, can we have another chat again in so much time? This is how we organize our physical health checks. It needs to be done in person. And it needs to feel like you're an integrated service, not that you've had a discharge letter that's gone from the EIP service and the GP's just picked up a discharge letter. It'll be pages long, I guess. So that single intervention, not many times a year, I think could make a very big difference because, you know, as a family member, I know who I can go to. And certainly for Mary, that would be crucial because you need to know her. You need to know who she is and you need to know what makes her tick, like anything in general practice.
Thinking about the sort of physical health checks, I guess it would be encouraging to have the weight, smoking check, alcohol, blood tests. Is there a sort of evidence base, Carolyn, for what we should be doing?
There absolutely is an evidence base outlined in the NICE guidelines, and obviously QOF is based on the evidence. So we should be ticking all the boxes that are in the guidance, but we should also be doing other things. So establishing a relationship, talking about cancer screening, sexual health, oral health, and also thinking about medication, because we know that some antipsychotics have more of an impact on HbA1c, on lipids, and on weight gain than others. And I think as GPs, when people are discharged on their sort of higher risk antipsychotics, so these are quetiapine, risperidone, olanzapine, we as GPs feel not very confident in changing them. We feel that, you know, if somebody's mental health is stable, we shouldn't fiddle with the doses. And we don't have easy access to CMHTs. If somebody goes into a crisis, we might get access to home-based treatment team and medication may be changed then. But otherwise, people will, I wouldn't say languish on antipsychotics on doses that may not be appropriate when they're stable. I also did some research a few years ago now interviewing GPs and psychiatrists about the metabolic side effects of antipsychotics and how would people feel about changing them when somebody's got weight gain. Should we be considering changing to aripiprazole or to lurasidone? GPs said, no, it's not our job. Psychiatrists said, well, it's probably our job, but actually we're a bit worried about doing that because if they're stable, if they've maintained an equilibrium, we don't want to shift that. So people are getting the side effects of antipsychotics and they're not really being addressed.
Just taking one example, like blood sugar. So if you're seeing someone who's beginning to get a little bit of a shift in the blood sugars, so they're fitting into a category of not controlling glucose brilliantly, but they're not reached the diabetes stage, this is a really important point in the trajectory towards diabetes. So access then to sort of approaches like formulin, I guess there are newer drugs as well now, but early monitoring and doing something about it. If you find that someone is beginning to get a shift in blood sugar. And the reason I pushed this particular one is that, you know, my perspective, if Mary's got complex problems, she hasn't got diabetes yet. The impact of having diabetes on top of a major mental illness would be horrific. And again, it's not so much the threat of dying early. It's the impact that that would have on someone who's very vulnerable and struggles to cope. So the opportunity to prevent a trajectory towards diabetes is a huge opportunity.
I think you're absolutely right, David. And often when we diagnose somebody as having pre-diabetes or non-diabetic hyperglycemia, you know, the HbA1c is between 42 and 48 in our locality, we'll send them a text and say, this is information to have a look at. That is not the approach we should be taking for people with severe mental illness. They should have a consultation, should be discussed with them and their carer. What needs to be done at this point? What about diet? What can we do about activity? Mm. Is there a weight management service we can refer to? And do we need to look at the medication? Do we need to contact specialist care and say, actually, this person's been on quetiapine for X number of years and now they've put weight on, they're pre-diabetic. Can we consider changing to a less high-risk antipsychotic?
David and Carolyn, you touched about the Leicester resource. Can you tell me a little bit more?
This is about the late Helen Leicester, and Carolyn and I knew Helen extremely well. But Helen and I ran a symposium in a big conference, in a big early intervention conference on physical health. And we said at the end of it, fancy a cup of tea, anyone who's interested in this. And Jackie Curtis comes wandering over. She's a psychiatrist from Bondi, clutching a positive cardiometabolic health algorithm that they developed for their local medics as a simple training tool. So Helen and my eyes lit up, and essentially we asked if we could nick it. And we brought it back to England. And then I was a GP advisor on the National Clinical Audit of, well, it was called schizophrenia in those days, Clinical Audit of Psychosis nowadays. And I was told by the director of this audit, Paul Elliott, said, David, your job is to nick this. So we spent 2 years proving what the Aussies did in a weekend. We managed to get every college, we got NICE involved with it. And Helen, I mean, she had such academic prowess. And because of Helen's health and the fact that she was dying at that time, she said, oh, okay, well, you know, I think we should call this the Leicester, was my request. So that's why we called it the Leicester Resource. So this is a simple tool. It was basically the health check that I was offering as a GP to anyone as a prevention of heart disease, diabetes, as we've talked about. But it was actually targeted at people who've got severe mental illness, and particularly those who are taking antipsychotics, because we recognise that this is a health inequality. And this tool was an attempt to create a shared hymn sheet. So it didn't matter whether you were a nurse or a doctor, worked in primary care or secondary care. It was a very simple hymn sheet which had the numbers on and practical advice about what to do if things started to change, you know, so cardiovascular risk, shift in weight, potential for diabetes, just those big things. And it very much aligned with the QOF, and Helen was a chief senior advisor on the QOF at that time, so it very much aligned with what the QOF was talking about and also what NICE was talking about eventually when it produced its guidelines for severe mental illness. So 15 years of my life, really. And we did recently update it. Perhaps something to talk about was Q-Risk. At that time, we were talking, I think, of Q-Risk 2 in the 2012-ish. So we updated it a few years ago. And because NICE had shifted their advice to Q-Risk 3, so it was an opportunity for us to update the Leicester. And so that's how the Leicester tool came into being and then has evolved. And at the moment, we're working on a supplement as well, because it's a bit adult-centric and we need to think about centile charts and stuff like that. But essentially, we're trying to get a tool that will run across early intervention services, particularly from the age of 14 upwards, and that primary care and secondary care is comfortable to sort of share and collaborate over. That's its essence. It's a simple tool for collaboration.
Well, with the mantra, it's not just about screening, it's about intervening. I think that's, you know, a key message from this podcast. But also, I think as a GP, we're still using QRIS 2 embedded in our EMIS system. And if we want to use QRIS 3, we have to go onto a separate calculator and re-add all the information. So we don't use QRIS 3. So there is a bit of a mismatch between what the evidence says and what we're facilitated to do in practice. Notwithstanding, as you said, David, that the Q-Risk anything does not hit the adolescents, and which is why we're developing the supplement.
I suppose it is extraordinary this tool actually has been taken up quite seriously by intervention services. I mean, I think back to 30 years ago, and believe me, there was nothing. No one was bothered at all about this. And I say, you know, pervasive atmosphere of smoking. But now every service knows about the Leicester tool. And they're actually, the National Clinical Audit monitors them on the uptake. That's beyond my wildest dreams from 30
really
years ago.
Really good impact, David. The other thing is, I think, to signpost people to Helen Leicester's being bothered about Billy video from RCGPs. Listen to Helen's impassioned talk, just fantastic and inspiring, and talks about Billy as an individual. And I think it really brings home that this is not just about QAF and, you know, your list of people on the SMI register. This is about individuals for whom physical health really impacts on their quality of life.
Helen's video is amazing. It's not rocket science. It's all about the Equality Act, basically. It's all about how you actually improve access for a population very vulnerable.
We touched a little bit, but how do we encourage people with SMI to get this physical health check or be seen? We talked a little bit about not just texting, maybe having recall team, that continuity. Any sort of practical tips from your practice?
At the time of discharge, I think it would be really great to have a joint consultation with the case manager, the person with SMI, the carer, so that you've got that foundation of a relationship. And then, yeah, don't just send a text and expect somebody to, you know, press on a link. And they may not have a smartphone. They may have some paranoia, so they don't want to respond to texts. So a personalised approach to people, whether that's ringing up by the recall team or by the healthcare assistant who knows the person or by the GP or by the receptionist. I started off in central Manchester. Well, I started off in a bigger practice, but then I moved to a smaller practice and the staff knew the patients. So the person on the desk would be the one who saw the person walking down the road to go to the co-op, or when they come in and the receptionist go, oh, that person's not very well. And that intelligence is really useful, and we can use that even in larger practices. The staff get to know the people who are in difficulties. And so it may be one of the receptionists who's got the relationship with somebody with an SMI. But I think the other thing is, you know, we expect all our patients to conform with our systems. Well, we have, you know, health checks are done on a Wednesday afternoon, or you can only have your diabetes check with this nurse at a certain time. I think we have to make the use of opportunistic consultations. So somebody may come in because they've got a respiratory illness, or they've got to come in for their medication review. Well, can you do some of that QAF work, the annual review, then? And you might not be able to do it all. You might not have a nurse who's available to take bloods, but at least you can start the process. So we're not just inviting people in, they don't respond, and we accept them. That isn't what we should be doing.
And David, touching about Mary's care, what's sort of happening with primary care interaction with your daughter?
We're very fortunate. Well, it's, bear in mind that Mary now is in a home with four other ladies who've got quite severe learning disability. So that's her setting. The practice nurse comes out, I think, a couple of times a year to actually visit the home. I mean, it's quite close to the surgery. There's always easy to get in. The staff at the home are great. They'll take Mary in if they've got problems. They don't even tell us now. They're very reliable, the staff. But they've got an excellent relationship with the practice, which I guess that you'd recognise. I'm sure that you'll have care homes under your care. And this is a very well-run care home, and they know the practice. So, I mean, Mary has sees a psychiatrist every 6 months. Communication is excellent. The GP knows what's going on. Over COVID, we had some concerns, and the GP was just brilliant at being proactive. Talk to me because I was worried, you know, as a dad. But the GP was absolutely behind Mary, and he knew her. And I was very grateful for that. So our relationship with the practice that I've seen is great. And it isn't just cardiovascular screening. So it's very well organised.
Just to summarise, any final thoughts or top tips into practice for GPs or other healthcare professionals listening?
For me, it's about continuity of care. Maybe with a GP, but, you know, it may be with a person who in your practice conducts the initial part of the health check, and that it's don't just screen, intervene. So when people have had the health check, that they have the opportunity to meet with a GP, preferably one that they know, to look at the HbA1c, to look at the weight, to look at the medication, to mention oral health, to think about smoking cessation, and to act on anything that we can address so that we can reduce the mortality gap.
I look now at Mary's late 40s, start off with one condition called a psychosis when she was 16. Now she's got four conditions, takes 11 pills a day. Her brother's similar age, no conditions, they don't take any pills. So the complexity is enormous. So you're dealing with different parts of the health service. But Mary's in this phase of multi-morbidity, but she's only late 40s. And so my overwhelming message is you've got to start this really early, that actually the trajectory towards having multiple comorbidities like Mary is now dealing with started when she was certainly 16. It may even be starting before then, before the actual psychosis broke out. This is very subtle, isn't it? So my message is get in early, make the systems work collaboratively early. And now, I'd say Mary's blessed, I think, with extremely complex care that's beautifully managed in a high quality residential care and well supported by general practice. My other message, actually, we want to be listened to. Our worries need to be heard, I think. But also our health's quite vulnerable too. And we're probably quite a high risk group for you. And so a little bit of a pitch in for carers too, that, you know, having someone take notice of your health and encourage you to come up for some regular checks, not unreasonable, because we are probably quite a high risk group for mental and physical illness.
I think you both commented really nicely about the importance, as you say, of continuity of that relationship-based care. What we can do as individual practitioners can be so important, being proactive, but also at a practice level, thinking about changing some of our systems, being more adaptive, integrating care with our local mental health teams. And yeah, it's really great to have you both on today. Thank you so much. And if you want to learn more, there's lots of content on the RCGP website with e-learning about physical and mental health issues. Thank you, Carolyn, and thank you, David.
Thank you very much.
That's a pleasure.
You were listening to the RCGP podcast. My name is Dr. Thomas Round. Thank you very much.